The House Committee on Revenue for May 22nd, 2007 will come to order. The first item on our agenda is the work session on House Bill 2641. We'll open that. Go ahead and Stephen, talk about that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2641, A and Gross, deals with the local option property tax. What the bill does is to increase the amount of the local option that can be raised before the local option revenue would become part of the regular local revenue in the school equalization formula. It increases the $750 limit to $1,000 per weighted student and the percentage from 15% to 20% of the school equalization formula revenue. So it would be the lower of those two.
The what of those two?
The lower.
The lower of those two.
The bill also indexes the $1,000 limit by 3% per year beginning in 08-09, and then it would also use those new limits in the calculation of the local equalization grant.
Thank you. And I note the sponsor of the bill is here in case anybody has any questions on the bill. It's been a while since we've actually talked about this. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, there had been only one comment noted on the record relative to concern for equity. Excuse me. I wondered if staff had any comment relative to any concerns over equity, because obviously some districts would be able to take advantage of this, whereas others, which may not have the growth and the escalation between the differences between 5 and 50, would not be able to take advantage of this, and this could create an inequitable situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's correct. Those districts that can get voter approval of it. And there's also an equity concept for the taxpayer themselves, not just for the district, because it will affect taxpayers differently in terms of how much of that local option they pay, what their gap is between their Measure 5 and Measure 50 taxes.
Residence by residence,
yes.
Right. Mr. Chair, we're in a work session. I would like to make a motion at this time that House Bill 2641 be moved to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves House Bill 2641 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Yes. Representative Berger.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to sort of reiterate for the record that having been a member of the school board when Measure 5 was passed, and I recall that one of the issues around Measure 5 was the unequal treatment of taxpayers and school districts in terms of funding, and one of the results has been a real attempt at equalization, and you can argue the formula is good, the formula is bad. You can make a lot of arguments about the current system, but equity issues certainly are still a part of sort of our thoughts around distributing funds to students in Oregon. This is a step in sort of the opposite direction. With that recognition, I think it applies only to one or two school districts that really have this capacity, and their voters will have to weigh in on a local option. So I am willing to grudgingly go down this path for the interests of those who feel that they want this option.
Thank you. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be voting to move this bill out of committee today. However, I reserve my right to change my vote when it reaches the House floor on the basis of inequity, principally that I also see this as lending itself to increasing disparity between those schools that can pass a measure and those that don't.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I've expressed the concern for equity, I also recognize that this is based, number one, upon a local vote, and number two, based upon the fact that we're moving out of equity in so many other areas around the state. And so I think that it is important that we recognize this is based upon local vote, and to the extent that some homes will have greater participation than other homes, locally the folks may decide that they don't want to do that and don't want to dignify the increase of the local option share.
Thank you, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also wanted to put some comments about the issue of equity on the record. When I served as a school board member, we actually established an equity committee I had the unusual experience of serving on that committee, and we spent a lot of time trying to determine what does equity mean when you're talking about education. And I think that whether it's access to education or, in this case, how you fund education, it's very difficult to quantify what that equity means. For example, is it equitable to provide the same funding to a school district that has increasing enrollment and one that has declining enrollment? What about the subsidies that we give to small school districts to offset the increased costs or the loss of the economy of scale? What about those that are able to do local option levies? What about those school districts that live in communities where their county commissions or city councils can provide subsidies either directly or indirectly through activity levies to their school districts? So I think that no matter how hard we try, we're never going to have a state school funding program that is completely equitable. I think the goal is to ensure that every child, wherever they live in the state, has access to a quality public education. I think what this does is continues to give tools to some districts, probably not those same ones that already benefit from some other tools that might not be available, that may not be available to those districts, to provide opportunities to their students. So I will support this bill today. I'll support it again on the floor. I think that it is critical that we give our local school districts every tool they can possibly have to provide a good education to our kids, because we're not completely doing our job here.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. The only comment that I would add is that I came to the legislature in 2001 because I was concerned about school funding for our schools. I would prefer that the legislature had sufficient funds available to fund our schools adequately across the board. Otherwise, I would adopt Representative Gelser's comments. I think she said it far better than I could about the issue of equity. And with that, are there other comments?
Move the previous question.
Please call the roll.
Aye.
Excused.
Yes.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion having received the required majority, the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much, colleagues. And with that, Carrier, Representative Buckley is here. Would you like to carry the bill? Representative Buckley will carry, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2641. The other item of business on our agenda today is the public hearing on House Bill 2735. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2735, and we'll hear a summary from Mary. Yes?
A long summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House Bill 2735A repeals 316-153, which grants mobile homeowners tax credit against personal income taxes subject to satisfying income eligibility required criteria if they're required to move their homes due to mobile home foreclosures. We'll say that in 2005 and 2007, around 1,700 plots were closed, and so it's been a housing issue for the last 3 years. Section 17 in this bill replaces that statute by providing mobile homeowners with a refundable tax credit not to exceed $10,000. Under current law, it's only refundable if you're in a lower income bracket, and it's non-refundable but with carry forward provisions if you're earning less than $60,000 a year and your home value is less than or equal to $110,000. This particular bill, Section 17, will go into effect, repealing the other current law, and will go into effect July 1, 2007. The amount of the credit can be reduced by the amount of that the household receives if it's paid compensation for exercise of eminent domain. Section 2 requires the owner of a mobile park, and this is a new provision, to pay each mobile home owner between $5,000 and $9,000, $5,000 for a single wide, $7,000 for a double wide, $9,000 for a triple wide, if the homeowner is forced to relocate or abandon his property due to the park's closure. Section 12 will exempt these payments from income tax, and Section 9 indexes these payments to inflation so that in subsequent years it would be 5,000 times 103%, let's say, a 3% increase if that's the inflation rate. Sections 21 and 22 repeal the current January 2008 sunset date for an exemption on capital gains derived from the sale of a mobile home park to a mobile home association. Section 4 prohibits local governments from adopting or amending a local ordinance, rule, or law that modifies local regulation of manufactured dwelling closures, except that they may enforce existing laws if they provide tenants with equal or greater rights than are provided under this Act. Section 23 freezes the assessed values of mobile home parks that are closed at their values on the last assessment rule preceding closures. The proposed freeze is limited to a period of 5 consecutive years, irrespective of their uses, zoning, or ownership of properties. It does not restrict the monetary savings derived from frozen assessments to the amount paid to tenants. However, the proposed 5-year freeze is subject to approval by local governing authorities, and I mentioned it and underscored it because 2 amendments to this bill deal with that issue particularly, and it will impose certain restrictions on the recovery of that amount that's paid to homeowners. Section 25 requires that the owner of a marina pay owners of floating homes the lesser of $3,500 or moving and setup costs if the marina is closed and the tenant is given less than 180 days notice to vacate the premises. It instructs the Department of Housing and Community Services to adopt rules to administer this section. That is the basics of the bill. And then there are 2 amendments, a dash 3 and a dash 4, which have some changes, but I've also noted in the dash 4 where the provisions are identical to the dash 3 or slightly different. Okay. Mr. Chair, do you want me to continue?
I think we'll go into the testimony, and as things come up, we may ask you some additional questions. And first, see if I get my names right here. First, I'd like to hear from our members who are present, and that's Representative Chris Edwards, and also Don Phillips, who's here for Representative Crummell. Representative Edwards, thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chris Edwards, State Representative from House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. This issue of mobile home park closures is particularly important to me, as many of my constituents live in mobile and manufactured home parks. It's been an interesting watching this bill move through the building has been interesting to me, to say the least, because the bill was originally the effort or the product of a collaborative effort of what's come to be known as the Coalition, which is represents both manufactured manufactured home owners themselves, the homeowners themselves, park tenants, and the landlords. These issues are not easy because with most solutions, it's difficult to find win-wins with these issues. So having said that, I support this bill. I'm particularly I would like to discourage the committee from making amendments that would weaken the protections for my constituents, all the constituents that live in the 36 parks in my district. Under the current form of the bill, what could end up happening is that a park landlord could decide to sell his or her park, and that park owner would then be required to negotiate with, say, a resident co-op, which in other legislation that we passed earlier this session, that legislation enabled the formation of these resident co-ops so that the tenants could actually buy their own park. And what a great solution that would be. But it probably requires, in order to make that a reality, there probably need to be some financial incentives involved. If they are not able to purchase the park, and the landlord then, of course, as was explained in the summary, would have to pay tenants $5,000, $7,000, and $9,000 for a single, double, and triple wide, respectively, for displacement, and then the $10,000 fully refundable tax credit. And that could be then used to help go toward the moving costs of moving their homes. I believe it is in the public interest of our state to provide a pragmatic solution to the displacement of manufactured home tenants. There is a concerning lack of housing stability, given the very real possibility of tenants having the land on which their home sits literally sold out beneath them. Residents should have the confidence in knowing that their housing is secure and that they will not be unexpectedly displaced without any means to move. This bill, House Bill 2735, assists tenants with possible moves and grants peace of mind to residents and their families, knowing that if their manufactured home park is sold, they will not have to abandon their home simply because they can't afford to move. I have heard that, as I said earlier, amendments may be proposed today. I'm urging you not to adopt the amendments. I'm urging you to leave the bill as is, with the exception of an amendment that I understand may be brought forth by the City of Eugene. I haven't had a chance to really go through the amendment yet, so I'm going to reserve my judgment on that. But let it be safe to assume that the form of this bill that I'm going to support is going to be the form of the bill that sticks up for my constituents in the City of Eugene, in the 36 parks that I represent, that are really facing a lot of uncertainty as land values continue to skyrocket and park owners have great incentive to sell parks. So I thank you for the opportunity to testify for you today.
Thank you, Representative. Don.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Don Phillips, Chief of Staff for State Representative Jerry Crummell. And I'm sure, as all of you know, Representative Crummell's worked very long and hard on mobile home park closure legislation for the past 2 years, pretty much night and day, even in the interim. We've been to park closure meetings. We've met with residents. We've met on an ongoing basis with members of the coalition. And I'm going to defer most of the comments about the components in front of you today to the delegation from the coalition you'll be hearing from in a moment. And I just want to kind of give you some overview picture from where the representative's coming from. He did live in a mobile home park for 10 years and owned his own mobile home. He helped his ailing elderly 80-year-old mother move her mobile home from point A to point B. So he's had some good experience from all sides on this issue. For the past 2 years, we've been working with the folks in Thunderbird, which is our large mobile home park in the middle of Wilsonville. It was there long before Wilsonville was even a city. And so that's been kind of a big issue for us in the district. And they had been warned right before session closed in 2005 that their park might be sold. Indeed, the closure notice came on Valentine's Day this year. And so we have about 100 folks there that are now facing moving their homes or moving their lives elsewhere. And for another look at the big picture, the coalition came up with what I call four-legged stool. And there's four basic components of responsibility that were in the original coalition package. And I'll let the coalition folks talk more about it. We've already lost one leg of that stool in the last committee, and we're hoping not to lose any more. We're hoping to keep this a shared responsibility model where everybody's got a little piece of the responsibility, including the state, local government, the park owners, and the park tenants to some degree obviously bear a huge burden here. What Representative Crummell's been mostly focusing on is the tax credit portion, and since you're the revenue committee, I thought you'd like to hear a little bit about the revenue impact and look at that in a bigger perspective. We had another bill, House Bill 2600, which just focused on the $10,000 refundable tax credit this session. We gained 79 co-sponsors in the space of 4 days. So you can see the interest in the building in getting something to help these residents. And we really look at this package of legislation as a mobile home park closure relief package, if you will, a triage package for these closures that are going on. As Representative Edwards mentioned, there is other legislation in the building to deal with helping residents purchase their parks or set up funds to do that and leverage various dollars that are out there. That's kind of a separate issue to what we're dealing with today. If you look at this in terms of I'm giving an elderly person in a mobile home, low-income family, $10,000 to help them move their life after the park closes, versus their next move might be a nursing home. And then we're looking at $65,000 a year cost to state taxpayers on Medicaid every year for the rest of their life. So from the state's perspective, there's a real cost savings there, a one-time $10,000 tax credit versus $65,000 per year, every year, for however many years they're going to continue to live. And that's really the bottom line here when it comes down to a lot of these folks. One of the things we put in the amendments, I believe it was in the last committee it was in, was we moved the tax credit up to January 1st of 2007 so we could help the folks in the two parks that have closed so far in 2007. And there have been only two parks in the first 4 months of 2007, which really shows you that the market is slowing down. We had approximately 15 park closures every year for the past 2 years. And so compare that, you're going to have two closures, probably six closures if we keep going at this rate, two every 4 months. So that's less than half the number of parks that closed in the last 2 years. So we're really seeing that slowing down in some of these hot real estate markets, and we expect that that slowdown will continue and level off at some point. We don't expect to see the rapid number of park closures that we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years. At the same time, we also want to mention that we want to make this park closure package available to folks who do need it so that if they do have this overwhelming situation facing them and they do have a park closed, that this money, this relief is available there for them to help them remain independent and living an independent life instead of going into a nursing home setting or welfare or some other public services that they have to rely on. I guess I'm going to go ahead and let the cat out of the bag. The fiscal on this that we've worked really hard with our great folks down in LRO on is $3.79 million per year, $3.79, which is, by my math, $7.78 million for the biennium. That's the bill sitting in front of you today. We're bringing you some amendments, hopefully, the next time we see you, and the coalition has signed off on this, to lower the tax credit down to a lower income level so we can really help those folks who are in the low income category at 200% of the poverty level or less, which is what the current law is. And I know that cuts a lot of folks out of the picture, but we also realize you have a lot of demands in front of you and a lot of other tax credits facing you. If we're to bring it down to just low-income folks at 200% of the poverty level, the fiscal will come down to $2.5 million for the entire biennium, which is cutting it by about a third. And I think that's huge. I think that's something that you should keep your eye on. And just to add a little perspective, because I know you all like to hear about how many tax credits we have in Oregon, we have $1.2 billion in tax credits alone on the books right now in Oregon. That doesn't count tax deductions or anything else, just tax credits, including the Cultural Trust at $3.7 million, Alternative Energy at $16 million, and the Film Production Development Contribution at $1.7 million. And Representative Rosenbaum's favorite, the Political Tax Credit, at $12 million. Representative Crummell offered up House Bill 2608 to get rid of the Political Tax Credit to help pay for this bill. Not one of the more popular bills in the building this session. If you look at just tax credits for housing, just for housing alone that are in your little tax booklet you get from the Department of Revenue in December, there are 24 tax credits and deductions and other tax incentives just for housing, including fraternity and sorority houses on campus that don't pay property taxes, vertical housing along mass transit, we're talking apartments next to the MAX line. Altogether, they total $436 million. And that includes a moving deduction, regardless of your income, which comes to about $15 million. So you can see there are lots of tax deductions and credits out there that are housing related. What's more deserving than helping seniors in a mobile home park who are getting kicked out of their community? And finally, this year alone in the legislature, there are 24 new or expanded tax credits, just the tax credits alone, that have come out for a public hearing or a work session so far this session. And just from doing some quick math last night on the information I got from LRO, those tax credits alone, just tax credits, this session total $60 million. Some of them include the biofuel development, emissions for biodiesel trucks and school buses, one for fish screening bypasses, one for donating food to the food bank, and one for donating your organs. So you can see there's a wide variety of them, and if you look at it in the big scheme of things of where our priorities are, I would say the folks who are here in the room today would tell you this is a huge priority for them. We do talk a lot about our priorities being education, public safety, and services who need our help the most. Low-income seniors and mobile home parks need our help the most. And I just wanted to throw in there the co-chairs have made a huge priority of affordable housing this session in their budget, and I think that this is a great way to help them get that in their budget and make that a reality. And with that, I'll answer any questions and turn it over to Senator George, too.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify on the $60 million and the new or expanded tax credits, have those passed off of a floor or those have just been introduced and have had a hearing?
They're still alive right now. They've either had a hearing and then your committee or the Senate Revenue Committee or in perhaps a Rules Committee, but they're still alive, either had a public hearing or a work session.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator, thank you for attending today.
Well, good to see you guys from the other side of that table. House member colleagues, Mr. Chairman, for the record, State Senator Gary George representing District 12. And District 12 is an interesting district because it's mainly rural country from Gaston to Monroe. We have 20 trailer home parks in that district. One of the things I'd like to share with you is something that came up about two or three weeks ago in the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and we had the realtors in before the committee with their commission, with their management unit, and one of the things we heard from one of their people was that property in the area of the Portland metropolitan area was being valued at somewhere now, this is the band around Metro, between $600,000 and $900,000 per acre. When I heard that number, my first thought was mobile home parks are gone. Mobile home parks are gone because that value of that property that those mobile homes is sitting on is so high, there's no way a person could reasonably be thinking about keeping that mobile home park. So that's why this bill is so important. If you guys look at the bill, A and Gross, you would think I'd be down here testifying against this bill because it's, you know, really what would appear to be an assault on the poor park owner and property owners. But I'm on the other side today because I'm telling you we're facing a crisis, and that is because of what we have done in this state as far as limiting the availability of land to build upon. We now have a situation in which it is almost predatory action against those who have property that might be converted to another use for either industrial or for homes. And of course, the most vulnerable are those folks who particularly have retired to their beautiful mobile home park and with the thought of living out their years there with their friends and all their community activities and things like that. And today, although we're sitting here looking at a situation in which they're probably the most susceptible to dramatic change. Now, my mom was the oldest of nine children. Now, what's the relevance of that? The oldest of nine children who took care of hundreds and hundreds of kids as she was growing up, a person who worked all of her life, probably one of the strongest people I've ever met. And I'm going to tell you what happened, though, is when my mom got to the point in her senior years in which my dad was gone and she was living in her mobile home, she lived in fear. I've never seen that woman afraid in my life that she was living in fear. I saw the damage that it did to her physically, and she eventually ended up passing on from cancer. I can't tell you that there's a direct relationship, but I saw the stress with this very strong person, what it did to her in her life. And I'm sitting here thinking, we've got to come up with some mechanism that can, in fact, provide some orderly transition if we have to, if it has to be that they're going to be moved from their homes. And if not, what do we do to protect them and keep them there with proper incentives? The bill, I would tell you, I don't believe is perfect.
But this problem is so great, we need to take steps. And I'm urging you to really look at this issue. And I believe I don't think we can leave here. We may have a slowdown, as it was just talked about, in the number of movements against mobile home parks. But I think it's only temporary. Is my district, being rural and being basically across the river on the other side, I can tell you the pressure from the growth along the Highway 5 corridor is now affecting those areas. So it's a case now where my district may be safe, and some of your districts may be safe, but the point of it is that many of the folks that particularly live in the Willamette Valley, their homes are at risk, and I believe this is such a major issue we need to take steps. Absolutely. I was just pointed out to me that Victor Manor and McMinnville, the most recent park closure, 34 units will no longer be available. So it's a reality, even today, with a slowdown in the market. The market's going to pick up, I believe. We're being told 1 to 1.4 million people in the Willamette Valley. The competition for those mobile home sites will become tremendously intense. So urge your consideration of this bill and take action, please.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for our members? Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I might just add one more thing. And it's been mentioned here, but I wanted to underscore. The fiscal doesn't take into account the increased burden and social services.
That's right.
for this state, whether it's nursing home care or other services. Folks that live in mobile and manufactured home parks, this is kind of a broad brush statement, but by and large are not living high on the hog. I mean, it's an affordable housing option, and if these folks are forced out of their park and have to undergo this undue financial burden because we don't enact appropriate protections for them, it will be an increased cost to this state. And it might not show up on the fiscal on this bill, but it's going to show up on the fiscal in other bills and in other budgets in other areas that are already struggling. So I just wanted to make that perfectly clear, and I think we can all imagine what that would do. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, representatives. Other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Before we get into the other testimony, I just wanted to note that I have a page and a half of people who signed up to testify. We have about an hour and 10 minutes for testimony, so you can see that the time is very limited, and I would ask that those who testify stick directly to the point, keep it short, in order to allow everyone who wants to be heard. And with that, I'd like to call John Van Landingham, Chuck Carpenter, and Pat Schwab, I think. While they're coming up, I should also add that if you have written testimony to give us, I promise the committee will take a look at it. And rather than read it, if you would hit the high points so that we can make sure everyone gets heard. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Lane County. I've given you written testimony. It's about 8 pages long. I'm not going to read it, and I'm going to try to jump through it and hit the points that I think are important to you. And what I want to try to do is do an overview of what else is going on in the session about park closures, describe what's in the bill and the amendments, and then address a number of issues which I believe you will hear about. And this would be our chance to give our side on those issues. I'm here on behalf of the Manufactured Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But, again, I've got a handout. It's got my name on the front of it, and I'm going to skip to the second. You've already heard about park closures and the impact they're having on the state. I would add that there are, we believe, about 1,400 mobile home parks in the state with about 56,000 spaces. The majority of those folks are elderly and low-income. The average value of their homes is about $25,000, and that ranges from less than $5,000 value to more than $200,000. Well, you don't normally think of that, of manufactured homes as having that kind of high value, but they do in some parks. Current Oregon law, and it's been this way since the legislature first regulated parks, in 1975, current Oregon law allows a park landlord to close a park with nothing more than a one-year notice. No money, no assistance is required. Never has been. So, you've heard about the impacts of closures on people, and let me jump to the second page of my handout that talks about other bills that are in before the session that will, we hope, address this issue. Let me start by distinguishing between those parks we think are going to close, perhaps the parks that Senator George described, where the value of the land is too great for us to buy them. The second track would be the parks that we hope to buy and preserve as parks. And the people that we hope would buy those parks would be resident co-ops through HB 2096, which has already passed the House and has a work session tomorrow in the Senate. So resident co-ops, nonprofits, and housing authorities or local governments who would preserve those parks as affordable housing. Okay. The second bill that I want to mention is that our own bill, 2735, has a capital gains break in it that's removing a sunset from a bill that you all passed in 05. We believe, and the capital gains break is for landlords who sell to those preferred purchasers, those purchasers who will maintain it as affordable housing. We believe that's only been used once, very recently, in this biennium, and that's by a park in Corvallis that just recently sold to its residents. The landlord sold to the residents. There, for your information, only two parks have ever in the state of Oregon sold to their residents, been purchased by their residents. That's using a model that's very expensive for the residents. And, for example, in the Corvallis Park example, the residents had to each pay $16,000 to buy into the cooperative, the corporation that owns the park, as well as pay rent. The other bills that are of interest are Senate Bill 984, which would expand an existing tax credit that you have adopted over the years. It's been in effect since 1989, and what it does essentially is give a tax break to lenders that lower their interest rate to affordable housing development by up to 4 percentage points so that an affordable housing developer can borrow money at 4% instead of 8%. With this expansion to use it for mobile home park purchases, we believe that we can finance about 80% of a park purchase using that and using a nonprofit bank consortium in Portland called NOAA that serves the whole state. And then and 984 has passed out of two committees in the Senate and is headed towards the Senate floor. The last bill that I want to mention is House Bill 3551. It is the Housing Alliance proposal to increase the document recording fee to raise money for affordable housing development. That bill had 2 days of hearings in Ways and Means last week. It will generate an estimated $35 million biennium. Some of that money will go to pay the other 20% of a park purchase for the residents. This concept is modeled after an example in New Hampshire called the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund. In 25 years, they have helped residents purchase more than 80 parks. In the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund example, just last month, the residents paid $400 to buy into their park, compared to the Corvallis example of $16,000. And their model is pretty much what we're trying to mimic here with these bills and technical assistance through CASA and the Community Development Law Center. Let me talk about what this bill does. It is long and it is complicated. One reason it's long, though, is that it amends two statutes that are very long on minor stuff, abandoned property, and you can ignore those sections. Most of us do. What the bill would do is a number of things. That's about the third page of my handout to you. First, it would not allow any shorter termination notices, 1 year only. It would require landlords to make payments. They do not now have to make payments, but it would require them to make payments up front before the tenant moves. That's extremely important because that will give the tenant some money in pocket before the tenant has to move out of the park. $5,000, $7,000, and $9,000 based on the size of the manufactured home. Those amounts would be adjusted annually by pursuant to the CPA, by Housing Community Services. Those payments would not be treated as taxable income. Right now, we've had one landlord in the Portland metro area who voluntarily paid $5,200 to residents to help them move. He did not have to. DOR treating that as taxable income. So we want to avoid that since it seems to defeat the purpose of requiring the payments. There would be no rent obligation if tenants leave early during the 1 year. Our experience is that once park tenants get a closure notice, they panic and try to get out as quickly as they can. The example Senator George gave of fear is exactly right. In addition, we would have no charge to the resident if the resident abandons the manufactured home. In the Portland metro area, our examples all seem to be that most residents are unable to move their homes. That may be because the home is too old to withstand a move. It may be because there are no vacant spaces to move to. It may be that they can't afford the move. And we've estimated the cost to move is between $15,000 and $25,000 per home. So we're expecting that a number of homes will be abandoned. The cost for the landlord to dispose of those homes is between $2,000 and $4,000. And in our bill, the landlord would have to eat that cost. We want to remove the sunset on the tax credit that your staff described. It is now a $10,000 tax credit. It's limited to those who can move their homes. And I've just described for you that many people are not able to move their homes, and it's limited by income. You've also heard Don Phillips describe the cost impact. We do not want to have the tax credit die because it costs too much, and we would certainly work with the committee to find a way, an amount that would work for you all. We want to remove the sunset on the capital gains break. I already described that. We think that will be important in the future to get landlords to sell to residents, which is the only win-win solution in this whole problem. The bill also proposes a five-year frease of property tax assessed value. Let me describe what that would do. It's not a waiver of property taxes. It's a freeze at the current level. So the landlord would have to continue to pay the property taxes. But it's our concept of how local governments might be able to contribute to the solution, and I'll talk more about that when I get to that item. The 12th item on my list here is preemption of local governments. The bill as introduced was a full preemption of local governments. The bill as amended by Consumer Protection Committee grandfathers those local governments that have an ordinance regulating park closures that is adopted and in effect within 90 days of the end of the session, so roughly October 1. There are four cities that currently have an ordinance. Wilsonville, Bend, and Oregon City copied Wilsonville. Eugene has an ordinance from 1989. I helped to write it. It is not much at this point, but Eugene's been in the process of working on amending that. And then other cities may seek to do something before that date. Mary described the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments. Briefly, let me just mention that the Dash 3 amendments, you heard Representative Edwards say he doesn't want any amendments. I think he would actually want these because they make the concepts work. There's some minor changes that are not substantive that make the concepts work, and then there's significant changes to the assessed value freeze, assuming it stays in the bill, to make it work that were suggested by the Department of Revenue. So if you want to keep it with the assessed value freeze, you need to make the Department of Revenue changes in the Dash 3. The Dash 4 has the same as the Dash 3s, except that it restores the full preemption, and that's what the coalition is advocating for. And then the bill makes some other changes regarding other elements of land use of landlord-tenant law that are important to landlords and tenants and not probably important necessarily to legislators. Let me talk about a couple of issues that I think you're going to hear about. One is you're going to hear criticism of this coalition. I've been working in landlord-tenant law since 1978. The legislature first adopted regulation of landlord-tenant law in 73, and in 75 it added manufactured housing parks. There have been no significant amendments to landlord-tenant law since 1975 that did not come out of a coalition of landlords and tenants. This coalition was formed in 1997. It has negotiated and produced compromise bills every session since 1997. This is our sixth effort at doing this. Previous negotiated bills have provided significant tenant protections on issues from registration, mandatory education and registration of landlords, abandoned manufactured homes, limitation on forced removal of homes, sub-metering, habitability requirements, a bunch of stuff. So it's an important effort that we've made. The coalition operates by informal consensus decision making. We don't vote. So the number of landlords versus the number of tenants is irrelevant. There are four groups in the coalition that have the power to block. Two landlord groups, one tenant group, and two legal aid lawyers. That's the reality of the world. If one of those groups says no, the bill doesn't move forward. This bill is not as good as many tenants would like. It's not what I, as a legal aid lawyer, would like. It is, however, on the leading edge of park closure regulation in the country. And it's a significant step forward for us as residents and as landlords. This coalition started working on this issue in August of 2005 and worked monthly or more often since then to produce this package. Don referred to it as a four-legged stool. What we hope to do was have park landlords, park tenants, the state, and local government contribute in some way to the solution. Park landlords are going to pay, I've already described. They're going to pay money. They're going to have to eat costs. The state, we're asking to contribute with the tax credit and the capital gains break. Local governments, we're asking to contribute with the preemption and the tax freeze. And residents are going to contribute in the sense that they will not be made whole. That's not going to be a full compensation for the loss of your community, the possible loss of your home, the cost to move your home. Let me talk also about a point that will be made, and that I, as a legal aid lawyer, would find just fine if I were the king, and that is that landlords should pay the whole freight, 100%. Let me first note that current law does not require them to pay a penny, and never has. And in fact, all rental agreements for parks, they're required to have written rental agreements, all rental agreements are required to warn the residents before they move in that the park may be closed with no assistance. So they're warned. One reason why mobile home park living is so affordable is that somebody else is investing the money and taking the risk on buying the land. Park residents don't own their land. Some older parks are on land that we have always expected to close, industrial or commercial land, especially older RV parks. And then imposing all the costs on landlords risks a lawsuit. And there are currently two lawsuits on two of the cities that have adopted regulations. And in one of those cities, Wilsonville, the landlord won. The other litigation in Bend is pending. We think that it's important for the state to contribute as part of this four-legged stool approach. You already heard about the kind of people that will be impacted and the demand on social services. So I won't go further on that. Let me talk, though, about local governments' contribution. We assumed within the coalition that local governments do not have the cash to help with this issue. So we assumed that the tax freeze would be a way to allow local governments to help without hurting them. Local governments will benefit from park closures. Nationally, many local governments don't like mobile home parks because they're low value. They don't contribute much in terms of taxes. One of the examples that's been circulating the building of a park closure in St. Helens, the existing property taxes paid by that park landlord is about $12,000. The expected redevelopment property taxes would be $90,000. So that's a $78,000 gain to those local governments. We're not begrudging that. But there is a benefit to local governments from park closures. And we hope that the the assessed value freeze would be a way for them to contribute. We don't intend for this to be an incentive for landlords. We don't think landlords, frankly, need an incentive to close. They seem to be doing quite well, thank you, as it is right now, without that. And we didn't expect it to be a windfall. And in the amendments to you, we've capped the tax freeze at 50% of the landlord's costs, and we would certainly be willing to discuss going lower. We don't view this as a moneymaker for landlords. We view it as a way for local governments to contribute to the package of benefits that go to tenants. Let me talk last about preemption. This is a statewide issue. It's not limited to Wilsonville, Eugene, Bend, and Oregon City. It's an issue all over the state. It's an issue all over the country. It's happening in many, many other states in the country. Parks are easy development targets. They're large, they're flat, they're serviced. Growth has come out to them, and their land is worth a lot of money. And even though the number has declined lately, we expect it will come back in a couple of years. Regulation of park closures is complicated, complex, and controversial. Two cities looked at it in the metro area and decided not to do it. One with a tie vote, Sherwood and West Lynn. And in part, they're influenced by a threat of litigation and the costs of doing that. In many cases, state regulation is the only way residents will ever get any help. A lot of local governments not only can't do it, but won't do it. They don't believe in it. Douglas County Planning Commission and Commission voted not to do it because they don't believe in interfering with private property rights. There are parks in Douglas County that are closing now. They won't ever get any help unless the state does its regulation. It's very common for regulated industries to trade regulation for preemption. There is a bill in this session, Senate Bill 1036, in which home builders would trade a construction excise tax to be used for school construction in exchange for preemption. It's not unusual. And that is the bargain that the landlords sought within the coalition. They're being asked to accept significant costs that they do not now have to bear. In exchange, they don't want other cities to impose greater burdens on them than this package. In a coalition, nobody gets everything they want. That's the way coalitions work. And if a member of this coalition, and as I said earlier, tenants have benefited significantly from this same agreement, if the landlords think that they can give up A in exchange for B and then lose B in the session, they won't have any incentive to negotiate with us next time. And there are still significant remaining issues that we hope to bring to the next session. So I'll close by saying that we feel like this is something that needs to be addressed this session, and we would be glad to work with you to find something that you feel you can support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. For the record, my name is Patricia Schwach. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. We appreciate you holding this session, whatever it's going to turn out to be. It's long, and I know that. This bill is a culmination of 28 months of work and give and take by the park landlords, the finance organizations, legal aid attorneys, park managers, and last but not least, the residents. We worked together for six sessions and passed a lot of very meaningful legislation. In the 20 months we worked on this legislation, we saw several parks closed and watched as most of these folks walked off with little more than what they could take away in the back of their car. The only exception was a park owner who gave his residents, even though he was not required, those who could not move their home and wanted to leave in 6 months, he presented them with a check for $5,250. I understand that about 95% of the people accepted his offer. Frankly, it was the only bright spot in what was a couple of sad years, as far as I'm concerned. The coalition before you, the bill before you, is not perfect. The landlords would like to give less. The cities and counties don't want to participate. The lenders are losing money. State revenue aren't sure how they feel about it. And the residents would like more. So everyone is unhappy. But it must be a good bill. Our aim was for a four-legged stool: residents, park owners, cities and counties, and the state. That is still our aim, but we have trouble with other groups who keep trying to saw one leg off the stool. I heard a rumor yesterday about a park that is closing, and my first thought was, if those residents are given a year's notice, they'll get nothing. I have since learned that this is not true, but I will ask you, if we don't do something to help the residents of closed parks, what will become of these folks? Many have been able to live independently, but if they're forced to move out of a low-income home, they'll end up in a facility that all of us are going to have to end up paying for. 5 or 6 months in the facility will take care of the $10,000 we're asking the state to hand off. I promise each of you that, and other members of the legislature, that if we have another park closure, we'll give you a personal invitation to come and sit through one of these sessions. It's something you'll never forget. I've made the statement I've been to way too many funerals in the last 2 years, and that's what I feel like these are. I ask you to pass HB 2735. It's taken 20 months of our work, so we hope you'll agree. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Chuck Carpenter, Garden Home Oregon. I'm the Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, and we represent about 500 manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon. And I'd like to express our appreciation and thanks to both John and Pat for working with landlords over the last 2 years, the number of meetings we've had, and actually over the last five legislative sessions that I've been involved in the process. I think we've come up with good compromises for the members of MHCO and for community owners in the state of Oregon. This is a difficult piece of legislation to support. As Pat has outlined and John has outlined for you, in the past and under current law, landlords who own manufactured home communities are not required to pay anything after if they give a 365-day notice. But one of the things we talked about in the coalition was the importance of bringing some stability to the marketplace. And although there will likely be continue to be park closures, there are some 1,300 manufactured home communities in the state of Oregon. And by far, most of those, if not 90% of those communities, will continue to be viable communities. But we need to bring some confidence to the marketplace, to those residents living in those communities, that if that park that they live in should close, we are willing to move people. We will not be able to move the house, perhaps, but there will be a safety net, so to speak, for them to move on to the next phase of their life. That is very important to both the residents who will continue to live in manufactured home communities for the next few decades, and is also important to the owners of the land, to the owners of that manufactured home community, that this remain a viable market. There may not be many manufactured home communities left inside urban growth boundaries, and that's largely because of the density that we need to build into those communities, into those areas, but there will continue to remain viable, wonderful communities outside urban growth boundaries inside Oregon that residents will be interested in buying and selling their homes in, and landlords will be interested in continuing to maintain. So we urge your passage of this legislation. From the landlord's perspective, it is to maintain some stability in the marketplace so that people, when they think of housing alternatives, and it's not always affordable housing when we think of manufactured housing communities, but that it becomes an option for them in many, many communities here in the state of Oregon. I would also like to remind the committee that there are very, very few states or local municipalities who have found an effective answer to this gut-wrenching problem. From Florida to Idaho to Washington State to California to Nevada, nobody has found a very happy solution to this issue. I think, from the conferences that I've been to, that from talking to my colleagues in other states, that Oregon is once again very, very progressive in this piece of legislation, that we have come up with a solution that takes into account all the people that are going to benefit and have to pay, and I think that we can all be very proud about this piece of legislation. It is controversial. There are people there that don't like it. I know there are residents that don't like it. I have members who do not like it. But somehow out of that, I think over the last 24 months, thanks in large part to John Van Lanningham's wisdom and guidance, we have been able to come up with a very good piece of legislation. And I hope that the committee will have the foresight to vote yes for this piece of legislation and allow us to move through the process.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one to Mr. Van Lanningham. John, with regard to the dash A1 and the A3, you say they're substantially the same except that the A3 and A4, that the A4 adds the preemption of local governments. Do we know, with regard to Representative Edwards, who presented the bill, of his feeling on either A3 or A4, he was somewhat concerned about any amendments.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Butler, I don't know the answer to that. I can guess, but I don't think it would be nice of me to guess.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think it would be important that we get the bill's sponsors' opinion of what these are, but I would appreciate knowing that. Thank you.
I agree. Other questions?
Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. I notice we have at least one person who's come from more than 100 miles, and I want to make certain that we get him in, Peter Ferris, and then I'd also call Barbara Mitchell and Fred Schwag. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and the rest of the committee. I have some...
Would you identify for the record, please?
My name is Peter Ferris. I'm a citizen lobbyist for a new organization called the Oregon Manufacturers Homeowners United. I'm here to testify in favor of this bill as amended, and I would suggest to you that probably... Senator Chris Edwards, we've been working very closely with him, would agree that the amendment, the dash four amendments, are not what we want. We want preemption. We want this modified preemption. So that's just for starters. I think I'll just say a few things here and try to keep under the 3 minutes, but this issue of whether, as Don Phillips says, the triage and funding are separate, it can't be that way. It's clear to us that there is no solution to this unless there is gap financing. And these tax credits are well-intentioned. They have never been effective. The original tax credits that the Crummell bill, which was passed in 2005, were ineffective. These new tax credits, which will be refundable, will just throw money at the problem. And I would suggest to you that if you take a look at a large park like Thunderbird, if a large park like that goes down, is closed, we're talking about $3 million, and you will never see it again. Whereas a gap funding, you could put together a package of $10 million. That is renewable. That is recycled. That is smart fiscal sense. So we really think that. In addition to that, I would say this about the tax credits, is that they subsidize the closure of parks. They give owners a subsidy in terms of closing them. And so this makes no good public policy sense to me. Why would you want to actually subsidize people who are making huge profits from the sale of these parks? It makes absolutely no sense. Finally, I would say this about this business about the four-legged stool, and the one of the things that Mr. Van Landingham is always mentions, because I've heard it so many times before, is about, well, the residents will not be made whole. As a matter of fact, we are not going to be made whole because we not only lose our homes, in Thunderbird, for example, out of that 290 spaces, only 20 units, or between 15 and 20 units, were moved by their owners to another place because there aren't any other places to go to. So they're crushed up and sent to the dump. And now that's a great environmental disaster, and it's happening. So I would suggest to you that this four-legged stool rests primarily on the residents. And what it does is that not only do you lose your home, you lose your community, and you lose your affordable housing. You can't go out and find anything like what you're paying rent. I pay rent $350 a month in my park in Walport. And if I were to lose my affordable housing, I can't rent anything on the coast for under $700 to $800 for a comparable place. This makes absolutely no sense to me. So I see this as an owner's bill, and I get a lot of criticism for this. I have been a member of this. I was a guest of the coalition. I spent eight months working to see if we could really compromise, and I just gave up because I felt that it was owner-dominated. It is owner-dominated. And so I thank you for listening, and I'll provide you with copies of my testimony.
Thank you very much. Please stay right there, if you would, please. You may have some questions. I'd like to hear from the other two on this panel. I know you're not together, but then we may have some questions for you.
Surely.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Barbara Mitchell. My husband and I reside at 3355 North Delta, number 45 in Eugene. We have been residents and homeowners in Lake Ridge Park, a 55 and older manufactured home facility, for 9 years. Now we feel threatened that our out-of-state owner might sell our 192-space park and evict us if the land values rise due to a proposed commercial rezoning to build a hospital across from our park. That's how we got involved in this issue at the state level. We testified before on House Bill 2735, a bill dealing with park closures that was put in by a group that has only two park residents among 17 members. We work with Representative Chris Edwards, Paul Hovey, and Nancy Nathanson, all from Eugene, to get the state preemption of local laws in the bill amended. We support this amended House Bill 2735 before you today. Sections 4 and 5, as revised, allow the four existing ordinances, including Eugene, to continue and be amended. Also, other cities and counties have this brief window of opportunity to pass local ordinances that provide equal or better protections than in the House Bill 2735, up to the effective date of the bill, which would be about October 1. This was a compromise. Monday morning, we received an email from Representative Jerry Crummell asking for support to, quote, add back a section to stop cities from doing their own local laws. And, of course, there is a different alternative to completely delete the preemption. But as I read House Rule 822, the Revenue Committee isn't supposed to be doing amendments that affect the substance of the measure. And I just now saw the A-4 amendments to Sections 4 and 5 concerning the preemption. These same amendments were not accepted in the Consumer Protection Committee. They adopted what's in your A and Gross bill in that committee, and we urge you to stick with that version. I did attach, I'm not going to give you my whole testimony, I attached what we said back in March to the Consumer Protection Committee. We see there are many problems with House Bill 2735 from our homeowner's perspective. It is primarily a park owner's bill. It isn't the best solution. But we know homeowners up north and south of us who are under threat of eviction right now, Thunderbird Park in Wilsonville and Saddle Butte Park in Roseburg, they need the financial assistance provided in this bill. There are small amounts from the park owners, with assistance primarily from the state in the form of the $10,000 tax credits. We heard Representative Crummell's assistant suggest those could be lowered. I know that most of the residents in our park would not benefit with that income restriction. And under the bill then, our double wides and triple wides would get $7,000 or $9,000. There's been a study in Eugene where we're working to improve our law, that only 80 spaces in the city are available. Many of those are for single wides. So our double and triple wides could not be moved. We could not move our homes, and we would end up with $7,000 or $9,000 only. We prefer direct state general fund dollars appropriated to an existing revolving loan fund to help residents purchase their parks. This keeps us in our homes and maintains affordable housing in our communities. Also, we support continuation of the capital gains tax relief to park owners who sell to residents. We oppose the five-year freeze on local property tax assessed value of parks, since this provides an incentive to close our parks for redevelopment. In conclusion, we ask the Revenue Committee to pass House Bill 2735A and Gross to the House floor as it was amended in the Consumer Protection Committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Fred?
Good afternoon, Chair.
If you would leave the microphone several inches away from your mouth, It won't distort quite so much.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and the members of the committee. My name is Fred Schwach. I'm president of Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. We're a statewide homeowners association.
Fred, if you would, rather than reading your testimony, it's fairly lengthy. If you could hit the high points, okay. That would be especially helpful.
We've got over 2,000 members, and in the last 30 years, we have managed to get past many, many benefits for residents. I think the thing that really gets my hackles up is when we are accused of selling out. This is not the case. You trade one thing for another. And as far as I'm concerned, I can tell you, after being married to Pat for over 30 years, she's one hell of a negotiator, I can tell you that. And the reason I'm concerned about this, too, is someday I may be a senior citizen if I live right. But the thing you've got to understand is to get the park owners to agree to pay $5,000, $7,000, or $9,000 for a home and then absorb the cost of dismantling that home. Trust me, the park owners didn't suddenly have a religious conversion. what happened is they said, okay, what are you willing to give up in return for that? One was preemption, and the other one was this tax freeze. The thing about the tax freeze that really frosts me is Washington County in particular is crying the blues about this. They will give millions of dollars to Intel, but they won't give anything to help people who really need it. And I don't understand that. That's just beyond my comprehension. Another thing is, as I understand it, Wilsonville has gone to court and lost. And further, as I understand it, because this is a loser-pays state, they're on the hook for about $300,000 in attorney's fees. And I said, as I understand, I'm not quoting this as a fact. It's what I've heard. And the thing is, also, I understand that Roger Ash has got deeper pockets than Wilsonville, and he swore he'll take this all the way to U.S. Supreme Court as he has to. So he won't have to win in court. He'll just break them. So I feel the best chance that all of us who live on leased land have is to have a statewide statute that the state has got deep enough pockets to defend. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Fred. We appreciate your testimony. Are there questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll try and be brief, but I'm getting a little lost because this is my first look at something that I think has been talked about by a lot of people over a lot of time. So if I could just clarify from this panel.
Please, go ahead.
Mr. Schwach, you support the original bill and this coalition group.
That's correct.
Okay. And Mrs. Mitchell, you support the dash...
The A and Gross.
The A and Gross, not any amendments.
No.
So you're in the same position as Mr.
No.
I just now saw the dash 3 and the dash 4 that you have proposed to the A and Gross. I know I don't support the preemption, the amendments in the A4 to the sections 4 and 5 of your A and Gross bill. I haven't had a chance to really read the amendments concerning the local.
Neither have I, but you do support the original bill.
The A and Gross.
A and Gross, right. And Mr. Ferris, you don't support the original bill. You do support the bill.
I support the amended form that you have before you.
The A and Gross.
The A and Gross. And I would say to you that we have a coalition of our own that we put together that included county commissioners. It has included AARP. It has included the four mayors of the four cities who have passed ordinances. We have had veterans groups. But what I'm saying to you...
Are there two coalitions or are there one coalition?
Well, this is the real coalition.
There are
Mr.
two.
Mr. Chair, am I confused?
I think there
legitimately.
Are two.
So there are two coalitions that both call yourselves coalitions, and one of you worked on this bill and
I
the
don't
other
call
one is...
I just said we were a coalition.
Okay.
We've developed that because we saw this as essentially a owner's bill. And that's
but you're supporting it.
We're supporting it now, yes, because of the preemption, modified preemption. You're right.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It's the modified preemption that we're supporting. We don't like the bill in general. We don't like the five-year tax freeze. We don't like the $10,000 tax credit, even though we know that it's important to people in Wilsonville and probably Saddle Butte. We understand that. But we're saying if we want to look down the road here, we need a comprehensive solution to this. And that means providing gap funding. We've had... OHCS had in their budget $18 million. The governor has...
Slow down. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to get to the heart of the matter. You support the A and Gross with the preemption.
The revised preemption.
The revised preemption.
Okay. All right. And there are two coalitions, and they're both coalitions. And I'm sorry.
Thank you, Representative
Berger. Okay.
Well, those were some of the questions I had as well, so I appreciate your going into it.
Okay.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. It's a question along the same line. So the three of you that are there, you're not all taking the same position. Mr. Schwach, you support the original 2735, but do not support the bill that's now before us.
As I understand it, I support the one that came out of the Landlord Tenant Coalition after 20 months of work, that as submitted by that group.
Right, and that's the bill with no letters attached.
No letters attached.
So as a follow-up, if I look at my, or if I'm reading my email and people are telling me to support House Bill 2735, they're not asking me to support the bill that currently exists. You're asking me to support a former version of the bill, and those that are opposing that are asking me to support the current version of the bill.
Preemption. We want the tax freeze, but we also want the 5,000, 7,000, and 9,000 payment to the residents by the park owner. We want the $10,000 credit. And another point I'd like to bring up, Mr. Chair, if I may. I sat in on a hearing that was being held by Senator Johnson regarding low-cost housing. And the statement was made in that hearing that a cost for a single low-cost apartment was $167,000. Okay, this tax credit would serve that same $167,000 would serve almost 17 homeowners that have been displaced. So, and the other thing, even if you said, okay, we're going to build low-cost housing for you with a five-year waiting period for low-cost housing, a lot of these seniors would be dead by the time their number come up to move into an apartment. This way you at least give those seniors something to get on with their lives.
Thank you very much. Representative Gelser.
So I had another follow-up. I think I now understand the difference in your positions on the iterations of the bill. But are you so opposed to the amended bill, the bill that we have before us today, that the coalition, including the tenants, would oppose the bill because it has a preemption in it? Or could you live with 2735A, the bill we have before us today, but the original bill just happened to be the preferred version that you started with?
Okay. I personally could live with it, but let's look at one other issue. This coalition has worked very well together over the last six sessions to create many things that benefit the residents. During those six sessions, we've gained a case of mutual respect and trust. If this goes down in flames, it's going to be a while before we will be able to get the park owners, I think, to sit down and negotiate in good faith with us.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused. I just have to admit.
Thank you. I am still confused.
I would like to hear, if we may, from Mr. Van Landingham again. It sounded like he represented a coalition that had a lot of legs to it from previously, and Mr. Ferris indicates that he represents a large group of manufacturers and county commissioners and so forth. I'm not sure, but I would like to hear about the present A engrossed bill as it's before us.
Before we do that, I have a question for Mr. Ferris.
Yes.
That has to do with his original testimony. If I may, I'd just like to ask that, and then we get on to answering the question you're raising. Mr. Ferris, when you gave your original testimony, you indicated that you were interested in GAP financing rather than tax credits. Could you expand just a sentence or two on that issue so that we understand what you're talking about?
Yes, this is the model that they've been using in New Hampshire. They talk about it here, but we don't get much action. But what essentially it does, the big problem here is the banks, NOAA, a group of banks, are willing to do the 80% funding for the purchase of a park, but the 20% is critical, and that 20% has to come from somewhere. And currently, the park that was just purchased by folks in Corvallis had to pay 10%, a 10% interest rate. You can't. That's in order to get it down to, as John suggested, $400. Per unit, you have to have a gap financing at 4 or 5%, and it's doable.
Thank you. Let me see if I understand. Just to save some time, let me put words in your mouth, and you tell me if I've got it or not.
Okay.
It sounds like you're saying, rather than the state putting in many millions of dollars in tax credits, it would make more sense for the state to help finance this gap financing.
Absolutely.
So that the owners could actually buy the park rather than have it redeveloped for some other use.
And I would suggest, too, that in cases that where the value is so high, what they're doing now in New Hampshire is creating new parks. So they could create it from the ground up. They're doing that in New Hampshire. We could do that here. So I don't think this is an either-or proposition. I just really think that this makes sense to really empower residents. And when we get into this blinders kind of thing, that triage and all that, we don't see the big picture. We need to see the big picture.
Thank you. I now understand your testimony, and that was the reason I asked the question. Thank you. John, you have an answer to Representative Butler's question.
Mr. Chair, I do. And I believe it was a question raised by Representative Berger and Gelser. The Dash 3 and the Dash 4 are the ones that you should be paying attention to. They both amend 2735A. I believe that Ms. Mitchell, when she gets a chance to read it, would support the Dash 3. What the Dash 3 does is make 2735A work. It makes some minor changes, and as suggested to us by the Department of Revenue, it makes the assessed value freeze work. Okay, you may hear testimony from the counties later that there's still problems with it, but that revision to the assessed value strategy was suggested to us by the Department of Revenue, saying that the first version that passed out of House Consumer didn't get much attention. It doesn't work that way. So if she wants the assessed value freeze to work in 2735A, you got to do the Dash 3. Dash 4 is different only in that it restores a full preemption. That's the issue.
Preemption.
They don't want a preemption? We want a preemption. Dash 4 is a preemption. Dash 3 is not. Dash 3 is a grandfathering of those cities that can do something before October 1.
All right.
Okay. I would like, if I could, to respond to your question to Mr. Ferris.
Yes.
If I could. We would all love it if every park could be purchased by residents, nonprofits, and CDCs. And I've been working on this for 2 years. I'm on the board of NOAA, whose commitment is to finance affordable housing development. We are not able, in our wildest dreams, to buy every park. Thunderbird Park is reportedly for sale for $30 million. Even with a $10 million fund, and it wouldn't make any sense to do one purchase with that money, even with that kind of money, we can't buy Thunderbird. Some parks will be lost. The tax credit will only be used for those parks we lose, that we cannot buy. So we're mixing apples with oranges. The fund that Peter has talked about is a great idea. I believe we're getting there through 3551. I'm not opposed to that. But that's to buy a park. Some parks we cannot buy, and in those cases, those residents will be displaced, and the tax credit will help them move. If you can buy a park, there's no need for the tax credit. It won't be used. They won't be displaced.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. So it seems that the substantive difference is the preemption and not the preemption. Why do you want to put the preemption back in?
Representative Gelser, Chair Barnhart, you weren't, I believe, in the room when I went through that.
Okay, I can follow
up. It's in my written testimony. I'd be glad to meet with you later and not make everybody else listen to me talk more.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. We do have a number of other witnesses, and I can tell at this point that we're unlikely to get through the list. I also note that Representative Schaffer is one of the sponsors of the bill, is in the back. Representative, would you like to be heard today?
Mr. Chair, could I make a comment?
Representative Berger.
Yeah. It would be most helpful for me if the folks would speak to the original bill, the A and Gross, the Dash 3s and Dash 4s in some way, or the preemption or something, because otherwise I'm lost in here with what you're supporting. The need is clear, but what you're supporting is lost.
I think that's part of compromise, isn't it? I think what we've seen here is an evolution of compromise.
Yeah, absolutely.
And lots of folks say, I wish we had this out of that last one that we had, but others have said, this is where we're at today.
And of course, Representative Berger's right on. Before we can figure out what we want to do, we have to know what it is that people are actually asking for. Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. Don't ask me to walk through all these amendments, because I'm not going to. It's like I'm walked into Palestine here. There was a question by the good vice chair here about what the sponsors of the original bill intent was on preemption. I'm only speaking for me, not the others. I support the preemption. I support grandfathering those that already have it. Wilsonville's in limbo, I understand. If they lost their court case, then they'd be preempted. And I will remind my friends up there that the statute is chock full of preemption. That's just the way it is. And so you treat it like a bad word. But I do want to just briefly touch on the issue on the whole, though, too. My constituents currently have nothing. They get nothing. I support the right of first refusal. I know that's not in here. And I also would support the state helping these folks when they can put a deal together to purchase these parks so we can keep them open, and help them find some financing. I have hundreds of constituents in my district that live in these parks, and if they are forced out, they'll have, especially if they're forced out with nothing, they'll have nowhere to go. This does give some transition help to them. It may not please everyone. It is a delicate balance. And one of the coalitions, and I forget what their name is, but it was a gentleman that was sitting here. They're the folks that brought the original bill. But currently my constituents have nothing, nothing. And if we don't give them something, we can't come together and agree on something, they're going to continue to have nothing. But the question about preemption, I do support the preemption in the original bill. And I'll do my best to answer any questions, but I don't claim to be. I'm not an expert. I'm just a legislator. So,
Thank you, Representative. Questions, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, sir.
We appreciate your testimony very much. Is Linda Ludwig back? Linda, would you please come forward? Let's hear from Dennis. I'm going to butcher this one. Mulvihill. And Kelly Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. I want to be very clear with you. We have cities that have supported the Angros version of the bill, and we have cities that are opposing the Angros version of the bill. My comments to you today are going to be directed towards the tax freeze. You're being handed out a handout that talks about some of the technical issues that we've had and concerns that we've brought forward in other committees. Real quickly, issues as to, in the A and Gross version, what the governing body is. There is no criteria there in that version for the governing body to evaluate what type of park would qualify for the freeze. There's no time limit provided in the Angros version as to when a park owner could obtain that freeze, as well as probably an inappropriate placement to circuit court for an appeal rather than the Oregon Tax Court. You'll see a lot of that remedied, I believe, in the A3 amendment. But let me talk about one piece there that it's important to me to bring up today that I don't see remedied yet. And that is the policy statement, the lack of policy statement attached to this tax freeze. Typically, in statute, when we have a tax incentive, we see some sort of state policy attached to that. And I still, within the course of this bill and the amendments, don't see that. I think it's very reasonable to say that if this bill is passed, it will increase the manufactured home park closures in the state. However, there's no direction or reasoning why park owners should receive subsidy from local governments when there's not a requirement for replacement or affordable housing, nor is there language in that policy that gives tenants a first priority or a first option to purchase those parks. From a local government perspective, that's the type of state policy direction that we would look towards in order to entertain
the tax freeze type of policy that we see both contained in the Anglos version and in the set of amendments that you have there today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Dennis Mulvihill.
Thank you, Dennis.
Washington County. Washington County would second what Linda Ludwig said about, you know, the policy here. This is a big issue, and I think that we actually should thank the coalitions. There's more than one out there for bringing it forward. Obviously, we've got a big problem in the state, and it needs to be addressed. Washington County Board of Commissioners has problems with 2735A, the property tax freeze. If you just left it in the way it is right now, that it is the fear of the Board of County Commissioners that you would have developers making money on the deal. In other words, they would make more profit because you've got a tax freeze, because they're going to be able to build these things out quicker than the 5 years, and you've still got a freeze. They can do it in, say, 2 years or 1 year. I mean, if you've got 10 acres, or let's do 5 acres, and you put one house on it, it's not going to take you all that long, and then you get, you know, the rest of the time as a tax freeze. So it doesn't work, but it's not linked up with anything else either. So a couple of other things here that I would suggest. It's pretty static if you're going to allow 5, 7, or 9 for the relocation costs. Different parts of the state have different economies. 5,000 for a single wide goes a lot further in rural part of Oregon than it would in Washington County. So the relocation, there's an equity issue here, and that gets back to that policy question. So perhaps allowing local governments to adjust it themselves to account for some local differences would be a wise way to go. Local economies and land values ought to be taken into consideration when you're coming up with a relocation fund. The other thing is that this bill does not account for disasters. Or what about economic hardship? Some parts of the state, maybe the person wants to get out of the park and wants to sell it, and they can't sell it for enough money to pay for the 10 trailers that are on there because he has to come up, he or she has to come up with $5,000 each. So why not allow local government to waive that if it doesn't make any economic sense? Or what if there was a flood? And there's no flexibility. It's very static. I think everything else has been said today, but I would, again, echo that from what the League is saying, and to tie it in with other things, and to take some of the inflexibility out of it and allow for local variances. And let me just sort of finish this. It seems like relocation costs ought to be a cost of doing business. I mean, I think the number, one of the numbers was thrown around that there's some of this, one of these parks is going to go for $30 million. So they have to come up with $5,000 per person that's living in a trailer. And you've got, you know, 100 people in the park. That's not a lot of money relative to that, what that thing is worth, that piece of property. And that's where it gets back to, let's, you know, scope and proportion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Ross, and I'm here before you on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'm going to echo the comments of Ms. Ludwig and Mr. Mulvihill on the issue of the assessment freeze, but I would first like to commend Mr. Van Landingham and the coalition for the work that they've done. This is a very serious issue from a number of perspectives, and I've long been aware of John's leadership and the coalition in general from my previous lobbying activity on behalf of realtors and home builders. The Special Districts Association is concerned about the freeze because there's already a couple of programs in Oregon law that deal with frees or exemptions for property taxes, urban renewal and enterprise zones, and these already have a significant impact on our special districts, especially fire districts that are almost entirely dependent on property tax revenues for their operation. So we would urge your careful consideration of adding another freeze program to Oregon law. I come at this issue from a number of perspectives. For the last over a year, I've been working as a consultant for the folks who are developing the mobile home parks in Beaverton that you've heard referenced, that voluntarily gave the $5,250 to the tenants. It's interesting that their costs on tenant relocation will total almost $1.5 million. The other costs that they will incur, which government could also have an impact on lessening, is the cost of the approval process, redevelopment process, to convert that park. And those costs will almost equal the costs that they've paid the tenants. So I think that's an area that could be looked at to streamline that approval process and allow more funds available for tenant benefits, and would certainly be willing to work with the proponents of the bill to examine that prospect.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably Dennis and Linda together. Relative to a statewide policy, presently if a park closes out in less than a year, 6 months, there's a $3,500 policy straight across the state. You're telling me that there's some inequity at 5, 7, and 9. Now, I've got some localities that I represent in southeastern Oregon that you can buy most of the town for $5,000. So I need you to again tell me why there's an inequity when we're coming back at 5, 7, and 9 for single, double, and triple wide, when currently the law is one size fits all anyway.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I think we won't quibble that the law needs to be changed. I was just pointing out that if you make it static, then that's what that park owner has to come up with, and maybe that doesn't work in some areas of the state. It's just more to build in the flexibility where your local government can say, Slim down the street there with his 10 mobile home park spaces can't sell it enough to pay him $5,000. So they need to be able to waive it. That was the idea.
I just needed to know that we are under kind of a standard formula right now today. So.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Alex Kyler, Charlotte Lehan, Doug Riggs, please. Mr. Riggs here?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Riggs had to go to another meeting.
Don Miner.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler with the City of Eugene. I'm a legislative analyst. I'm not going to address the tax freeze issue. I think that's been covered quite enough. My testimony today is going to center on the preemptive language in House Bill 2735A. In consumer protection, there was some additional language that was inserted by that committee to address the preemption that was established in the initial 2735. City of Eugene, in discussion with the other cities that are interested in this issue, including Oregon City, Bend, and Wilsonville, have asked that 2735A has still some problems with that exemption language, in that 2735A provides local governments with about 90 days to get an ordinance developed that would provide greater protection. 90 days for a local government is simply just a very narrow window of opportunity. We probably, in fact, cannot get an ordinance written in 90 days. So we are asking for an amendment, I believe that's in the works, that would amend 2735A to provide a 180-day window of opportunity so that local governments, if they wish, can have that amount of time to develop an ordinance. I'd note that the City of Eugene does have an ordinance that is going to be in front of our City Council in June that will update our current ordinance that provide, and if adopted, will provide greater protections in 2735. That work started last May, so the City has been working on that one for over 365 days by the time it will get to City Council, so you can see the implications for what I'm talking about. And we expect those amendments are coming. We would not be supportive then of the Dash 4 amendment, which restores the full preemption. That's just not a tenable situation for the cities.
Thank you. Madam Mayor.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, excuse me. My name is Charlotte Lehan. I'm the mayor of the City of Wilsonville, and I submitted a letter, I believe you have, that was signed by submitted by myself and the other three mayors of the cities that have ordinances that we have worked on for a long time. And I want to say that I think there's probably no one in the room that might be overreaching who doesn't think we need a statewide statute to address this issue. That isn't the matter. I think we all can agree on that. We're most concerned though with the preemption because local governments, I think, can address this in ways that fit local circumstances and find local solutions to local problems. I agree with Mr. Collier here in terms of the everything he said about the preemption. I would agree that we need 2735A, the A engrossed version, and and 90 days is definitely too short for any local government to deliberate, for a local community to effectively deliberate on an issue like this and come up with an ordinance they can support. But for cities that don't are not interested in pursuing an ordinance, and many are not, many cities or counties would not be interested in pursuing an ordinance, and they could rely then on the state statute as a sort of default position. I just want to mention, in terms of this four-legged stool also thing, local government in general, state government or local government, was never part of that negotiation. All of those deliberations were only a couple of tenant groups and quite a few park owner groups or representatives. And what happens, if you look at this solution in general, and while I support 2735A, I share the concerns of Washington County. What's happening here is the cost of relocation is being shifted 100% to the taxpayers, either to state government or to local government, and it's being done by that tax freeze, which recoups more than 100% the 579 that went out up front, and the state government share is even greater. So local government and state government, who were not part of the discussions, are the ones who ultimately are bearing 100% of the cost here, of the relocation cost, the actual out-of-pocket relocation cost. In addition, it does leave local government then with a reduced tax base on which to do anything in terms of affordable housing. I raise that without having an amendment before you to propose, but just that I think you should consider that and what Washington County said.
Thank you. Mr. Miner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. Our association represents manufacturers and their suppliers, retailers, lenders, not park developers. Given our first choice, parks would never close. It certainly doesn't serve our interests. But we recognize, and we have since last session when we helped with the bill that passed then, that this is a problem, and it needs a solution. If anything, the problem has intensified since 2005. I don't know if you've all seen the Oregonian articles, the lead stories on the 6 o'clock news, but those are heart-wrenching stories. People's lives are being destroyed. They lose their home. They lose their equity. They lose their savings. Oh, in many cases, they still owe a mortgage on the house. This is a problem that really needs fixed. We think it continues because it's driven, at least in our opinion, in part by urban growth boundaries, which force growth into a small area, notwithstanding demand. So properties are being redeveloped. In Representative Berger's district, there's at least one, maybe two golf courses that are being closed and converted to housing. Does much to improve our quality of life in South Salem, I think.
That's right outside my district.
Oh, okay. But the parks are seen as, you know, they're just large parcels of land that can be redeveloped. So we think this is going to continue. We think we need a statewide law. The park owners came to the table in large measure. The basis of the bargain for them was a single preemptive law. If they get a statewide law and then have to fight it city by city by city, they would never have compromised. In terms of the freeze, it was never the intention of the coalition that the park owner recoup all of their investment, all of the money they paid to the tenants. In fact, the residents groups use that as a wedge to get the landlords to agree to more money. Because I think it's been pointed out earlier, existing laws, they don't have to pay anything. I think, at least from our point of view, that the park owners and the residents have struck a fair bargain. It's probably the best bargain that can be had. I know it's not perfect, but it'd be awful if the perfect became the enemy of the doable. And I close my remarks there.
Thank you very much. We have two more witnesses, and I'd like to call them, and some of us at least will be able to stay to hear those, and those are Al Baker and Ann Taylor. Are you here? And I will say that we're at the time when our committee generally is closed. I'm going to stick around for a few more minutes so we can hear the last two of you, but as some members have to leave for other committees, you'll understand. Please, go ahead.
First?
It makes no difference.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. I live
Would you state your name for the record,
oh,
please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Ann Taylor, and I'm real happy that you're here. It was a half-sense timing, I guess. I live in a... I'm going to add some grapes here to the mix. I live in a travel trailer, but I also live in a park that has mobile homes, but they're old mobile homes. And it's becoming a nightmare. The park continues to deteriorate. It's been sold, and our rents go up. And there's many issues here, but my question is, why can't the developer, they have all the money, why can't they settle with the people that own the whatever they own on the land and then buy the property from the landowner? Why does there have to be all of this that the park owner has to pay? Because quite frankly, what happens is the land values keep going up and up and up, and then the rents keep going up and up and up, and pretty soon nobody's going to be able to maintain the property. You know, it's a nightmare where I'm living. We have trees that are dropping limbs now onto damaging structures. They're infested with termites and bugs, and I am paying an exorbitant amount of utility because the utilities aren't divided up right. I mean, there's many, many problems with these older parks where you don't have the land under it. I think we need more parks like that, especially with triple wides and double wides, you know, that can't be moved. But a lot of these older homes cannot be moved. So it should be replacement cost because the price of property keeps going up. And the developers need to honor that. In my situation, I can move this old trailer, but where can I move it to? You see, it's a travel trailer. It could be a shelter for the rest of my life, but I am on a fixed income and I'm trying to go through school so I can get off of this fixed income and fix it up. I am Why not have sweat equity? I would like to fix and restore this trailer. It's a 62 Travelease. I happen to like it. And it's been my home for a number of years, and I have maintained it. But with the increase in utilities, I have to have insurance. Mm-hmm. So everything, and then the increase in rent, I don't have any money left. So at some point, I'm going to lose my home, and I will probably then have to live in a tent.
Thank you. You're in the same kind of box that many people we've heard about today, I think, are probably in. We really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Baker.
Good afternoon.
And again, if you don't hold it right against your mouth, it'll work better. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Al Baker. I live in Washington County in a park, Seminole Estates, which is between Beaverton and Hillsboro. I'd first like to tell you about my parents, who lived in a park along TV Highway in a similar area there. A few years back, well, actually in the 80s this was, they moved into a park there. They bought a mobile home for about $30,000, and this was in the 80s. It was one of the nicer homes in that park. And they, right after they bought it, they announced to us that this was going to be their final home that they were going to live the rest of their life in. Well, as it happened about a year and a half or 2 years later, they got a one-year notice. The park was being closed. It is now a shopping center. My parents, this home that they paid $30,000 for, they felt they were one of the more fortunate people in this park. They got $2,000 for that house. They sold it to some other people that moved it on to some property they owned. But they were one of the more fortunate people in that park because they were even able to get $2,000 for their $30,000 home. That's one story. Anyhow, so I'm living in this park in Seminole Estates. In our area, within a three-mile radius of Seminole Estates, within the last 2 years, 8 out of 11 parks have been closed. 8 out of 11 in 2 years within just 3 miles of our place. You think our residents aren't frightened? We are frightened. And we have had an effort ongoing to try to buy our park, but unfortunately the owners have turned us down and they say they're not interested in selling to us. I'd like to talk to you about these the payments to tenants that are in this bill for $5,000, $7,000, and $9,000. Thank you very much. We appreciate getting something. But let me tell you, we have one person that just recently moved into our park. He moved from an adjacent park. It's actually an adjacent property, but because of the driving distance, about 1 mile driving distance to get that home moved. It cost him, for his double-wide home, $30,000 to move that home. By the time he did all the utility work, by the time he did the landscaping and everything to get it back up like it was in the former place, $30,000. Thank you very much. $5,000 or $7,000 or $9,000 is a whole lot better than nothing. But, I mean, we got it's still an enormous financial loss to people whenever this happens. The other thing is, you know, we have 211 homes in our park. I would suggest that if that park was closed, probably only a couple dozen at most of those homes would ever be able to be moved, because you can't move them in, you can't find places to move them to. Whenever we had a few places vacant in our park, the management would not allow any home to be moved in there that wasn't, it had to be less than 10 years old to move in there. Most of our homes are, you know, 20 and 30 years old. They're not going to be allowed to be moved anywhere. And so what happens? You go and you lose your home. You can't move it anywhere. You have to have a dumpster moved in, and it's knocked down, and you get charged for the demolition and disposal of your home. So not only do you not get any money, you end up getting a bill to have your home disposed of. So as far in regards to what I support in terms of this bill, I'm not familiar with the various forms of this bill to be able to tell you exactly which forms I would support. But I can tell you I certainly do support any kind of payments that we can get for tenants. A little bit is better than nothing. I would support help to tenants that so that they can purchase their parks. Any kind of form of help that we can go so that tenant organizations can purchase their parks. I think that's one of the best ways to have a solution to this problem is to have tenants be able to buy their parks. And certainly anything in the bill that would support a right of first refusal for the tenants to purchase that park is certainly of interest to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. We appreciate it. And as you can see, there's an enormous interest in this issue. At this time of the session, when we're getting toward the end of the session, the committee members' time runs out before the testimony does, and I apologize for that. We appreciate the testimony of everyone who's testified here before us today, and you've handed us a knotty problem. We're going to see what we can do with it and hope that we can do something that will be helpful and useful in dealing with this very difficult situation. And with that, thank you very much for coming today. And with that, the public hearing is closed and the committee is adjourned. Thank you.